answers. But rather, I'm going to try to at least give you my feeling of where we are in the overall development of this idea of a phenomenology for quantum gravity. And the stages, by this premise, the stages of the seminar should be clear. I will first have to clarify where we are in establishing the ability of this phenomenology to discover new physics. And for that, I think, and most of you have contributed to that achievement, we can claim we have some ability to discover new physics emerging from this research program. Then, in a certain sense, going up a ladder in the level of ambition of this phenomenology, the next step would be to prove that we not only can discover new physics, but we can attribute it to one theory or another. So where are we in establishing, at least that in principle, this program is able to discriminate between different phenomenological scenarios. And finally, and that's where the seminar will be painful for me, I will talk about where we are in proving that this phenomenology can falsify theories. Most of you don't need it, but let me give you just one of the 10 slides that usually compose my speech at this point, which is the traditional belief that you couldn't do any phenomenology with this physics was not due, at least in the minds of the wise ones, it was not due to the expectation that there wouldn't be striking new effects, possibly, not necessarily, but possibly emerging in quantum gravity. If you simply admit one of the most common expectations, which is that the space-time classical continuum picture breaks down at the Planck scale, then you are immediately invited to scrutinize. None of these phenomena then is inevitable, but certainly by the simple assumption that space-time is no longer a smooth classical geometry, you are immediately invited to test, as a phenomenologist, various features, fundamental features, quotes, fundamental, that are actually linked directly to the classical continuum picture of space-time, like the classical continuum Poincaré-Lorentz transformations, CPT symmetry, at least in as much as linked to Poincaré symmetry, the equivalence principle, at least in as much as it is linked to locality in its own way. Then you could even, that's very hard to do, but in principle you could even look for actually a manifestation of non-classicality of space-time, which would be perhaps more striking and exciting discovery. And through somewhat more indirect, but equally strong, I would claim, also an invitation to consider decoherence. So the possibility of striking effects, and you know, depending on which one is your favorite framework to try and do a quantum gravity, some of these you will like more or less, but anybody working in this field is willing to expect at least one or two dramatically new effects. The reason why there was no phenomenology until not long ago is that we were too scared about this scale. Okay, the Planck scale, faraway Planck scale, which should be in our usual reasoning about how new physics enters in experiments at lower scales than the physics, than the relevant scale, should be providing huge suppressions for the effects. Okay. This story you all know. But I needed to make it just to say that the one goal that the punchline is that the one goal I think we really achieved is to show that we have the ability to discover, the ability to get lucky if we get lucky, okay, which is not much. And actually could be expected to begin with. The arguments claiming that you couldn't hope to do a phenomenology for Planck scale effects were really very weak, even within fundamental physics itself, We are all familiar, we just probably didn't realize the link, the possible link, but we are all familiar, for example, with studies of grand unifications. We test grand unification theories by one of their very weak predictions, one of the weakest. Proton decay is something that comes in with the probability of proton decay comes in with the fourth power of the grand unification mass, which is actually a scale very close by our order of magnitude reasoning, very close to the Planck scale, and it is suppressed by fourth power, okay? Yet we know that grand unification models are done by phenomenologists, and they are under huge stress by the pressure of experimental data. This is because there are ways to test small effects. Of course, if you monitor one proton, it might be very hard to establish that it lives for 10 to the 32 years, but if you monitor many, many protons, then you do. So with a simple experimental idea. And actually, one of our gods, which is Einstein, I think everybody in this room has, to one level or another, a religious feeling toward that figure. Actually, one of his smartest things is the work on Brownian motion, which, if you think about it, is another example of how, by gaining sensitivity to the collective result of many small effects, you can study physics at a distant scale by observation at a rather ordinary scale. This is just to say that the goal we have achieved, and we have achieved the goal of showing that we could discover, we could get lucky. It's not so much, you know, even the description says it. We have proven that we could get lucky. We could discover new physics by the type of measurements we are proposing. And I'm proposing for the last few months that we should really, when we advertise this, say, abroad, I mean, outside the field, the best way to sell it is the following one. Let's take the idea that space-time is discrete, okay? An idea that nobody in this room likes. But the fact you don't like it, not discrete, I mean, Lee is laughing. I'm thinking of a rigid lattice of points. So it's unbelievable. You know, space-time as a rigid lattice of points is ridiculous. Of course, fancy things like discretization of geometric observables in clever ways, that's different. But I'm thinking, imagine that space-time is actually a rigid lattice, something that conceptually none of us would accept. Well, I think we are very close to make it a scientific fact that this is not the case. Okay? And this is a huge difference for those like me who have invested in this field. From the fact
I have objections with random dynamical
random. That's your view, I mean, and I guess I share that view. I'm saying that
no one in this room likes the lattices. I said
no, but what I meant is a rigid, stupid, rigid lattice.
Something
nobody like us would, nobody, well, maybe somebody. I should know at Prima that I should be more careful. But Nick and I don't like a rigid lattice of points. But this was not enough for us, because the fact we don't like it amounts to nothing. I mean, we are pretty close to a scientific statement that this is not the case. And we are not really yet there, but we are very close in as much as this rigid discretization of space-time inevitably lead you to one or another modification of dispersion relation of this form. And here I'm assuming you have somehow created a lattice which has some surviving symmetries, okay? Space rotation symmetries, for example, and this might not be the case in your picture, but you will always end up with a quadratically suppressed, if the lattice spacing is 1 over E Planck, okay, by accident, if the lattice spacing is 1 over E Planck, you end up with some corrections to the dispersion relation, to the energy momentum dispersion relation, you end up inevitably with some terms which are quadratically suppressed, that they might depend on only one or all four, or depending on the discretization you do. And what we have robustly established over the last few years, it's actually a simple calculation that was established in one afternoon, is that if you compute then the threshold for photopion production, which was discussed in yesterday's very clear seminar on the Auger Observatory, you will remember from that seminar it was clearly stressed how this process actually, the resonance, the delta resonance intervenes in amplifying the cross-section, but the threshold for this process leaves a strong imprint in the structure of the cosmic ray spectrum, and that imprint would be completely washed out if you allow a term like this, actually with a negative sign for eta. So we are ruling out very specific types of discretization, maybe. Yet, we are actually in a position, by the fact that this threshold is basically seen, I mean, we saw data yesterday which start, I mean, and correctly, the political line was prudent, and as it should be, but we're very close, I mean, the experimentalists are very close to being able to say that they have seen this threshold, which, in appropriate cooking of these discrete spacetimes, should not instead be there. So what we have proven, what I mean the ability to discover, I mean, what we have proven through our work of the past few years is that we have sometimes sensitivity to effects introduced genuinely at the Planck scale. Okay? The thing about this discrete lattice picture I'm proposing, which is not appealing at least to Nick and I, is that, however, it's something where you have genuinely introduced structure at this faraway scale, the Planck scale. Yet we are basically at the stage where we can prove that that can be falsified. And this is the big achievement, the only robust big achievement of these years of work. And not so big in light of what I said a moment ago, it should be expected. But from the expectation to actually doing it, of course, it's a big step. Now, once we have done this, I think we should switch gear. I mean, now we have a different task. Now, we have somehow established legitimacy of doing this phenomenology. Now we should go about doing it, and which is a different task, the one of arguing you can do it, and the one of actually doing it. And what I mean could probably become clearer as the talk progresses. The points I'm trying to make is two points that are major concerns from the perspective I'm taking today of the overall development of quantum gravity phenomenology. One point is actually and it can be done much better than I did on the previous transparency. The fact that we have ability to discover with a smart analysis could be really shown very strongly. And if we, and the ability, I will give some hints, that if we discover a new physics, we might even recognize the imprint of some phenomenology we already have in mind. Okay. So discovery might be ready to use, let's say. Now, but the bread and butter of a phenomenologist, and I think this is not clear to those who have not done phenomenology earlier, the bread and butter of phenomenology is actually to get negative results. You know, chances are 99% of the results you get in phenomenology are negative. It would be funny if you start a phenomenology and every effect you measure is a surprise. You know, it's a bit the tone that some of us, not necessarily myself, but in some of the earlier enthusiastic meetings, the expectation was that every measurement we would make in a few years will give a new physics effect. Okay? Instead, the case is going to be that most 99%, maybe 99.9%, will be negative results, which is equally good for a phenomenologist. Okay? I like the killer side, basically, as you could imagine. Some of you know me better, might imagine. And so, usually the killer side is at work, because we get negative results. The problem is that I will argue that because of the peculiarities, the Planck scale, the smallness of the Planck length, actually, ultimately does not prevent us from doing the phenomenology, but when we are doing it, it creates some difficulties in extracting from negative results of experiments meaningful, intelligible constraints on model building, which is what the phenomenologist typically does. You know? With the exception of the few times in which it strikes really lucky, usually the phenomenologist does some measurement, the results are providing meaningful, intelligible constraints on model building, and this is going to be a bit more tricky than in other phenomenological efforts. Now, because of the situation on the theory side, we have another uncommon challenge for a phenomenology. Usually, I was a particle physics phenomenologist at some point, and usually, you know, you had some theory which you could really compute on, and then gradually experimental evidence of some effect emerged, and the competition was between the robust theoretical result being gradually compared better and better with this improving theoretical evidence, experimental evidence. There is no theoretical evidence in other areas of physics. Here we have theoretical evidence. That's the charge. So the theories we are working with, at least the most ambitious ones, they are, well, in some cases we don't know even if they are falsifiable in principle. Okay? If they're providing us with a fair challenge for the phenomenologists. I mean, if the theory is not falsifiable, we shouldn't be playing with it in the first place. Probably physicists should not be playing with it in the first place. And other theories, let me take the example of loop quantum gravity. I guess it's fair to have the intuition that this is a falsifiable framework, and as such a legitimate physicist effort. Yet, it's very difficult to manage the formalism, at least in a deductive, robust deductive way, to the level of producing definite predictions at the present stage. So the situation is that we are, on the experimental side, we are hoping to get improving experimental evidence. And in the meantime, we hope that theorists will be getting improving theoretical evidence. But only when the two things converge, we will have some meaningful confrontation of theory for experiments. Usually what we do now, and I will have an so that I show that I'm not biased, I will take my favorite theoretical framework and show you how we are trying to emerge, failing so far, from theoretical evidence to prediction, so that it will be clearer what I mean. But usually, theoretical evidence means that there are some parts of the calculation you actually can do, and some other parts you cannot really do, but you kind of recognize structure in your theory that suggests how you should proceed, and then you stick them in, okay? By this kind of procedure, you get valuable intuition for the type of effects. So the discovery direction is good, but you don't get any opportunity to falsify the framework because the error cannot be reverted. Before I go into that, let me just, most of us are involved in this, so it's kind of a celebration, but let me just stress that there are a number of experimental efforts going on from this perspective, for good or bad reasons. I mean, we succeeded. Maybe they've been fooled to listen to us, but we have objectively succeeded in motivating some experimentalists to do the data analysis we wanted. And while one message even for people in this room, which might be valuable, while most is true, is mostly linked to the test of Poincaré symmetry. Okay, one sector or another Poincaré symmetry. Let's not forget studies of CPT symmetry, which actually have a very long tradition, and things that I'm sure Nick described in his talk are reviving the field, which had been somewhat dormant, from a theorist perspective, for a while. And actually, Michele and I and Antonino Marciano have something cooking there. Might link to what Nick has presented. Decoherence, which is something I will not touch upon, but most in this room have some familiarity with it, is being tested both in neutral chaos and in interferometers. And while not necessarily from the Planck scale perspective, but tests of the equivalence principle are have a long tradition. So if we have a Planck scale phenomenology from it, it's ready to be done. Now, so this is where we are in trying to get lucky, basically. We have lots of shots. So we could get lucky because we are trying to shoot everywhere possible. Now, discriminate, I'll try to make, of this long list, which I wouldn't even have time to spend 2 minutes on each, I will select two of my favorite examples. But not so much because they're my favorite, but because they can allow me to show that at least traces of ability to discriminate between different phenomenological scenarios are there for this phenomenology. To do that, let me just remind you of one traditional quantum gravity phenomenology analysis. We'll go back more on the theory side this afternoon for this, so I will be quick today without justifying it. I remind you that somehow, And it is theoretical evidence. It's not. I don't think any of these results would be called a proof, but or a deduction or a derivation. But there is theoretical evidence in various approaches to the quantum gravity problem that the dispersion relation might be modified by Planck scale effects. And assuming some things that we sometimes forget to mention in papers, you know, assuming that this dispersion relation is modified, but the Heisenberg principle is basically a modified, or at least not modified at the same level, and that you're still able to rely on a Hamiltonian setup, then a modified dispersion relation with these conditions amounts to a modified relation between velocity and energy, which in particular applies to massless particles. So photons would have a wavelength-dependent speed. And we have clever ways, not so clever actually, but simple idea. If the speed depends on energy, but in such a weak way, with Planck scales of pression, you better find a very long race to figure out that there is this velocity difference. And gamma ray bursts were the first example where we figured out that the race was long enough. What I'm really excited about, I'm not sure I can spend too much on it today, this story is old, most of you know it, using the gamma ray part of the signal of a gamma ray burster will clearly, within a few years, allow us to access in these formulas values of eta of order 1 and smaller, so type of sensitivity we dreamed of a few years ago. I think we are basically ready to claim that when new neutrino telescopes like IceCube will be taking data at much higher energies, actually, than the gamma rays observed in, say, by GLAST, forthcoming, forever forthcoming gamma ray telescope. Well, okay, I'll describe it as forever forthcoming, because I said it was forthcoming in 2001, sure.
That's fine. That's what I've come before.
Anyway,
the IceCube will come before all of them, basically, and we might have a neutrino telescope looking actually at the same, able to look in, to look at the same effects with quadratic, not linear, but quadratic suppression, which is qualitatively a fact, you know, on the strength of this phenomenology. The ability to look at quadratically suppressed rather than linearly suppressed effects is clearly very significant. The fact that we have a few examples where we can achieve quadratic sensitivity is rather impressive. Certainly during the first years when we were doing this, we were not expecting such development so soon. Now, a partly related a role is played by the law of conservation of energy momentum, but the dispersion relation is also used to compute the threshold value. This is already used when I described the cosmic ray story earlier. I'm going back to it. The energy momentum dispersion relation is also used, together with the law of energy momentum conservation, to compute threshold for particle production processes. And this is the point I was making earlier about the cosmic ray data getting ready soon to actually set strong limits on some of these test theories that I'm implicitly referring to. So there is now the game I'm playing. So let me assume that Auger. The fact is, Auger suggests there isn't such a threshold anomaly for cosmic ray. At present, I would describe it as a suggestion. Okay, prudently. I mean, it's perhaps even more than a suggestion, but let's be real scientists and say it's a suggestion. And for in-vacuo dispersion, which would be the thing of the rays, the wavelength-dependent photons, we have increasingly good limits. I'm not even myself up to date. Every few weeks there is a new paper improving slightly on previous limits, or perhaps obtaining similar limits, but in a more robust way. I mean, it's a large field now. So the prudent way here to say is that also here we have negative results. However, there is this intriguing, I think John Ellis must have talked about it, there is this intriguing, not yet really probably a fully mature analysis, but an intriguing indication from this paper analyzing magic gamma ray data that actually would lead to a positive, you know, would amount to a positive if one day it becomes more robustly established.
I'm not going to dwell on these two statements. It's not really, as you are seeing, it's not the perspective. It's my usual perspective, but not the one I'm taking today. But let me instead use this historical situation this year of these two announcements, okay, the cosmic ray data that are becoming more robust and this preliminary evidence of something interesting from the MAGIC data. Now, what would that indicate? What if indeed, you know, many test theories that have been publicized in seminars are test theories where you would have both a wavelength-dependent speed of light and a modification of the cosmic ray threshold. These are theories that break Lorentz symmetry in one or another way. What if, this is just an exercise, okay? Because, well, the cosmic ray situation is rather robust, but the MAGIC situation is new and still unsettled. But let's do the working assumption that one day we have robust, we establish as facts that there is no cosmic ray GTK threshold anomaly, but there is invertible dispersion, okay? That would still rule out many of the advertised test theories which would predict both effects, you know? If you predict both effects but only one is found, it's not like you're 50% right, you're simply wrong, okay? So that would falsify much of the theories used to do these analysis, you know, to motivate these analysis, because you cannot get, you know, right only one in two times. And so that, those would be falsified. What could instead accommodate exactly, and on this I will say more in the framework of non-commutative geometry this afternoon, what could accommodate exactly this situation where there is no GTK anomaly, but we do find anomalous invertible dispersion? Well, you need, you basically could go to the direction I proposed a few years ago, which is to allow for departures for Lorentz symmetry, but without the emergence of a preferred frame. This dot should be lambda, some length scale, some funny thing of transferring files from one computer to another. The idea is simply that mimics what was done in going from Galilei relativity to special Einstein relativity. The Maxwell, the data providing support to Maxwell equation were at first interpreted as data providing a manifestation of a preferred frame, but eventually we are better understood not as a manifestation of a preferred frame, but as a manifestation of the need to describe more accurately the laws of transformation between observers. So no preferred frame. These turn out to be a much softer class, as I will describe this afternoon, a much softer class of departures from standard Poincaré array symmetry. They are unable, in practice, unable to provide an observably large threshold, GZK threshold anomaly, in spite of what is said in many doubly special relativity papers. And many papers in this line, they start with the motivation, we would like to have a large threshold anomaly. That's not possible, as I will explain this afternoon on basic considerations. And instead, it is fully possible. Again, I must go to, for the theory side, I must postpone to this afternoon. It is perfectly reasonable to have invertible dispersion in that framework. So we have the, this is my favorite also for, this is biased, why is it favorite? This is my favorite example of the ability to discriminate. So by using two experiments and yes, no situation, we end up favoring one phenomenological scheme with respect to another. So this phenomenology, at least to that extent, and which is not a very deep ability to discriminate, but the first level ability to discriminate is certainly there in some cases. Now comes really the painful part, and I don't have much more to say than I already said. For what concerns the situation for falsifying theories, it's what I described. You simply cannot ask us to falsify theories if you don't give us falsifiable theories. And now, in some cases, the theories, we don't know if they're falsifiable. In other cases, actually, it's very likely they are falsifiable, but we need to get, for falsification, we need certain, robust, inevitable predictions from the theory, so the theories might be mature enough to derive effects. A similar situation in a less popular approach, the one the path to quantum gravity that goes through non-commutative geometry. The idea that we go there slowly. Let's first learn how to deal with the non-classical space-time, then eventually we'll learn how to do non-classical general relativity, okay? So we start in this line of, in this path, is a less ambitious path toward quantum gravity, at least more gradual. We start with just trying to understand what happens if you are dealing with a non-classical space-time geometry. In spite of being less ambitious, still we are at the stage of theoretical evidence, okay? Very much so. But since it's a framework where I'm familiar, and it is a simpler framework, I can really explain you what I mean by the transition from theoretical evidence to predictions. And I will use a recent result we obtained in Rome, not because it actually achieves the prediction level, but because it's an intelligible step in that direction, so it can explain what I mean by that path. So let me first introduce very briefly. This afternoon I will look more to the technicalities of this framework, to look from the deformed symmetry side, which I'm trying to somehow illustrate tentatively by this framework in the talk I give this afternoon. But for my purposes here, let me just quickly explain that you start off with some position about the non-commutativity of coordinates, okay, which I'm here writing the one which is intriguing by certain tastes. And the mathematics appears to invite you to describe symmetries of theories in this space-time in terms of op algebras rather than Lie algebras. The reason is that when acting on product of fields, I'm here showing product of exponentials, but that then follows straightforwardly. The action of symmetry generators on product of fields is funny as a result of the non-commutativity. And this is related to something we were discussing yesterday about non-locality. This is a rather, in some sense, pervasive non-locality, because it's not localized in the region, but very soft for other reasons. So I'm not sure how it fits into standard categories of locality criteria, because it's a relatively new formalism. But it ends up providing this hint that the symmetry should be described op algebra. Op algebra is just the right structure to handle this funny feature in the tensor product of the algebra of fields. So the action on the algebra of fields on a single copy is relatively standard, but then the action on the tensor product is funny as a result of non-commutativity. This is just what basically op algebra is tailored to do. And this I don't, maybe this I will touch this afternoon, but I don't need now. By analyzing this op algebra, those who are curious about it can come to my afternoon talk. But by analyzing this op algebra, we end up with the result. Yes, it looks like the symmetries are governed by this op algebra. And oh, wow, the Casimir of this algebra is different from the standard Casimir. Okay. This is robust. So far, we are going not theoretical evidence. This far, at least generously speaking, would be really a derivation. Okay, the Casimir is deformed. Of course, in the lambda going to zero limit, the limit in which the space is commutative, this Casimir goes back to the standard E square minus P square structure. Here, T and P really represent generators. Okay, I'm just using the notation that was used in the old days of this stuff. Here, the proper role of these objects E and P is as generators of the symmetry transformation. And you find as a rather robust result that the Casimir of the algebra is deformed. Now, from this, what you do if you're proceeding in the theoretical evidence spirit? Oh, wow, I have a deformed Casimir. Oh, well, chances are, I'm not able, for many years we were unable to use these symmetries, to analyze these symmetries and derive conserved charges from them. This is the major development that I'll try to describe this afternoon. But for many years, we were unable to obtain conserved charges. Really, the dispersion relation that we would like to measure is a relationship between the conserved charges associated with these translation symmetries. So if you want to have a prediction for the phenomenology, you cannot stop at the Casimir. You should obtain the analogous result for the charges associated with this symmetry. Since that result was not available, in a certain sense, it's still not available. I explained this afternoon, but we have made a major step. I mean, we do obtain conserved things from this symmetry. Now, challenges to understand what they are, but we do have conserved things from these symmetries. After 15 years of failure, we do that. But up to a few years ago, this was not possible. So the phenomenology of this Kappa Minkowski was done stopping here. Okay, we have some theoretical evidence through the fact that the Casimir is modified, that the dispersion relation between energy and momentum will be modified. Let's test it. Okay, good. And this is, of course, when it's the best you can do, which it was, is what, if that's the best you can do, you do it. But if you find the effect, well, if you find the effect, that's still very interesting, in spite of the fact that it's theoretical evidence. If you find the effect, that's why I mean discovery is easier than falsification, much easier. This is a well-known fact of phenomenologists, but not all of us were trained as such. I mean, it's obvious that discovery is easier than falsification. If you see something new, at least you know what you discovered is sometimes difficult. When you discover new physics, it's sometimes difficult to know what you discovered, but that you discover something new is easily established. But when you get negative results on this dispersion relation, are you if you stop here, if you stopped at the Casimir result, are you falsifying Kappa Minkowski? Of course not. Of course not. Because from Kappa Minkowski, you have derived a Casimir relation, and you don't know what is the relation between charges that you're testing. If you find that the relation you have guessed is wrong, your guess is wrong, not the theory is wrong. If at some point, as I'll describe in detail this afternoon, we might be a bit closer now. If at some point from Kappa Minkowski we could actually derive the energy momentum dispersion relation, then we would have an example of a falsifiable framework. Because then there would be a robust deduction from the first line to what I dream about in Kappa Minkowski is a robust deduction from the first line to the last, leading to a testable effect. And then I dream not to find the effect and to kill the framework, if you see where I come from. We are not ready. Sure.
The relation per se depends what kind of constraint you want to do, but the mathematics per se is not enough. You may want to have the full quantum field theory as well. Like if you want to do rates, if you're looking at shifts of thresholds which are there.
I have a slightly different vision from yours, but that's not exactly, not really the point here, because I'm not making the point. I mean, are you saying that in principle you cannot test the dispersion relation, then you would be wrong? You're saying in practice.
I'm asking you what kind of constraint you would be so sure that you can ignore the quantum, whatever form of field theory there is.
I'm making a slightly different point here. I'm not saying that specifically if you get the deformed dispersion relation, then you will be able to test it. That is in principle test. Now we have definite prediction. Now, in practice, that's the usual work of phenomenology. That, you know, the usual work of phenomenology is that theories give you something which is definite. Then, of course, it's not always easy, and you're right. I mean, at least...
I thought it was a thing in practice.
In practice, it is true at least that in most cases, I'm not sure it's true in all cases, but I agree with you that in most cases it might be difficult to test the dispersion relation only knowing the dispersion relation. Although I believe there are some exceptions. This goes a little bit beyond the point I'm trying to make. I mean, that would be a definite prediction, and that would give us at least a chance for you and I, who are trying to be real phenomenologists, to go there and crank our minds to test really the thing. Maybe we fail because in practice then it's not possible, but it's not the failure due to theoretical evidence. It's, thank God, the failure of phenomenology would be a sign that, you know, it's just the phenomenology doing its thing. So on this, I will... say more this afternoon about these results we got on doing the Nedra analysis and what they suggest also for phenomenology. For those who are here for the phenomenology talk but not this afternoon for the theory talk, there is a challenge which perhaps is more fun to pose to younger people in the field. So I will describe this afternoon that we together with the ability to do this Nedra analysis, which we recently achieved, we also found an obstruction for a pure Boost transformation. Okay. And whenever you want to make a Boost transformation in these geometries, because they're fuzzy, I mean, a posteriori is not so strange, but it was truly unexpected, at least by me. What we found is that the fuzziness of the geometry is such that you are not allowed to perform a pure boost. You cannot say in classically sharp sense that you are performing a boost. Whenever you perform a boost, you also have some quantum, some non-commutative parameters of transformation switched on for space rotations. How do you test that? This is not something which I propose today because I don't know how to do it. But it's certainly a new, you know, really kind of, it would be if somebody has idea on how to test the inability to do pure boosts, that would be really kind of a striking new insight on fuzziness of space-time, I guess. I will argue this afternoon that this is one of the most, probably one of the most robust predictions of space-time fuzziness might be a no pure boost principle. But of course, you don't have elements this morning to agree with me. You will have elements to disagree this afternoon. And now the... Of course. No, this is our theoretical evidence. This is theoretical evidence.
You don't understand how it translates to the way you compare moving observers.
It's theoretical evidence. I gave a definition for these other results. Yes, the no pure boost is theoretical evidence. It's not at the stage of the theory. Now, one final point. I guess I have 3-4 minutes. I came. How am I doing? 5 minutes?
Actually, you have enough more, 18.
I have 1 hour from the talk. Good.
Yeah.
And then 1 hour from the talk. Good. So I can explain this slide. Now the final. All right. It was your talk 45 minutes. Right? Okay. That's jet lag, Giovanni. Okay. Now the final but beefy point I have is now. I mean that what I've said in the last 15 minutes is as much as I have to say about the immaturity of theoretical frameworks, providing thereby just the theoretical evidence, how it is affecting us working on the phenomenology side. We have to invent way to translate negative results of experiments into meaningful constraints, but that meaningful is an art form, because it's not a meaningful bound on parameters of well-established theories. Now, I'm closing with the last few transparencies to tell you of another way in which I recently realized that the smallness of the Planck length comes back to harm us, okay? After all the happiness that, in spite of it being so small, we could provide a few examples where sensitivity to Planck scale, genuinely Planck scale effects could be achieved. I'm starting to feel that then we will nevertheless pay a price for that small scale. The general logics of my concern is the following. Whenever we find an experimental context where such small effects can be picked out, it inevitably means there is a large amplifier, large ordinary physics amplifier around. For example, in the cosmic ray threshold argument, although not often stressed, but there the amplifier is the boost with respect to the center of mass frame for the process. There is a huge boost, and that large ordinary physics number happens to be in front of the small Planck scale effect in the analysis, leading to this striking possibility for Planck scale effects to show up in rather ordinary, although ultra-energy data. Now, the concern, and this is also a result of discussions with Luis Urrutia, recently, I became more concerned with the fact that then we might have to nevertheless pay a price for the smallness of the Planck scale of the Planck length in the following sense. Now, if you are dealing, so every experiment, this is merely a theorem, every experiment, unless we have something magical like large extra dimension that gives us a huge discount on how costly it is to do Planck scale physics. But if the Planck scale is the Planck scale, the usual one, then we inevitably, quantum gravity phenomenology experiments will be experiments where there is around some dangerous, and now describe it as dangerous. At first it was a big opportunity, but a dangerous large number. Because if you are able to do quantum gravity phenomenology, it means that, as in the case of the large boost for the cosmic ray analysis, you need some large number, ordinary physics number there to amplify your effect in the first place. Now, all we are able to do, however, when we are leading order analysis. Now, what is the status? My latest concern is the following. What is the health of leading order analysis in a framework, not in a framework, but in an experimental situation when you know that there are around a surprisingly large number, unusually large numbers. Of course, the boost with respect to the center of mass available for the cosmic ray GZK analysis is nothing funny, it's a fact, but it's an unusually large number. Now, when you do a phenomenological analysis and you have around this huge number, ordinary physics number, which you are grateful for, because it's the reason why you are able to do your phenomenology, what happens, however, to the health of your leading order approximation? You're stopping a leading order. The reasoning for stopping a leading order was, well, the next two leading orders are much smaller. Yeah? They are much smaller because there are extra powers of the Planck scale. Well, one second, but we have around, in the experimental context, some huge numbers. This is why the leading order is visible. So basically, with Luis, we've been playing with some examples where this might hunt you back, and that might be an invitation to sharpen up the phenomenology. One concern that I have is this dispersion relation, when velocity is simply obtained by deriving energy with respect to momentum, these dispersion relations, when eta is negative, I guess, in this convention, they would at some point turn back. You know, it would no longer be monotonic. First of all, in principle, I'm concerned that this might not be what nature wants to do. You know, it might still be weird enough to allow departures from Poincaré symmetry, but want to keep the relation between velocity and energy monotonic. Of course, I mean, experimental data should say that this is might be a reasonable theoretical prejudice, but only data can say. However, what is also true, and in a paper that Luis and I are preparing, we'll provide some examples. I don't know if I have it on my slides. No. But you can actually explicitly write extra terms here. Very nonlinear, okay, but you can write extra terms there, which you would neglect at low energy, but at the point where you go above this maximum point, they become non-negligible.
Near to the Planck scale, right?
Okay. No.
Right.
No, it's a square root. I know where that, you know, it's roughly the square root of, it's the third root of m squared e Planck. It's far from the Planck scale. It's far from the Planck scale. For example, an electron of 10 to the 15 electron volt is a volt. We should, it's a simple question. Anyone of us can do it in a few minutes. But I can make as a definite statement that an electron with 10 to the 15 electron volts, if a is of order 1, is above the hill.
Are you saying those higher order terms essentially resum and lower the peak?
Sorry?
Are you saying that those higher order terms can resum and essentially lower the energy of that peak for the beginning of the non-monotonic state?
Oh, I'm not sure. The specific formula I have in mind, I should...
Can you show us the formula? I just want to see it.
You know, with exponentials, I mean, the specific formula is not very compelling, but what you...
Just write the formula, sorry.
If I have...
let's try.
No, but I don't... It's not... The formula is not crucial. I don't even have one specific one.
Oh, it is crucial, but because the peak is... I mean, I don't see how...
Assume... Let me give you the simplest example, this one I remember, okay? Assume you have... Let's see. What happens to the hyperbolic tangent at... when the numerator becomes 1, it becomes large, right, and is otherwise very small. Okay. So such violently nonlinear exponential functions, this is an exponential function, a low energy is completely negligible. So if I add it with one way or another down here, it doesn't make any difference at low energies. But as soon as T becomes of order, the third root,
you're doing a dimensional event.
Yeah.
And there's a mass.
This is the mass. This is Q. How could you not see it? But you would have seen, if you let me write what I was writing here, you would have seen it. Is this working somehow? Well, in this case, I've written the wrong formula, but when E is of order EQ plus, no, this is not. I will show you this afternoon. I can easily find that an exponential function, which triggers at energy of order, you can probably find it in a few minutes yourself, triggers at energies equal to n squared e plus. You can tailor with exponential functions an exact cancellation at low energy, but you something that then becomes order 1 when it approaches a certain scale.
Actually, it's up. We have to do this calculation.
But it's not this one. It's not this one. Or is it 10 to the 15 you don't find? Then 215 you must find.
No, it's... okay, let's discuss this.
We'll do it over lunch and we'll show it this afternoon.
What model did you have in mind to give you a test?
What mass...
What model? What kind of model did you have in mind to give the saturation of energy?
At this stage, we... It could apply to any of the models, any of the theoretical energy.
A Gabrielli model or something? Some kind of a Gabrielli space-time?
Well, not necessarily. What I'm saying is that in most approaches where we can argue for these leading order corrections, we have complete no control afterwards.
I know you have no control, but you have imagination. And I'm asking, when you use your imagination, how can you imagine?
No, I'm not actually, I didn't want to I don't want to imagine. As a phenomenologist, I would like to have a robust analysis placing limits on eta. If I cannot exclude something coming out from higher order terms, I will never have a robust limit on eta. This is the point. The other example, this is more directly linked to what we heard yesterday on the cosmic ray situation, is the following. Now, both, again, this dispersion relation, and think of the cases where, like in the cosmic ray story, actually, most of you know, there is also an issue of absorption of gamma rays by a similar argument to the one described partly yesterday and partly by me today for the cosmic ray photopion production, there is also a mechanism for an analogous argument for gamma ray absorption. So if you have TV gamma rays coming from distant sources, not the cosmic microwave background radiation, but another portion of the background radiation, the infrared portion, is a good target to make electron-positron pairs. So you again need to compute a threshold energy. And the delicate thing we stumbled upon in discussion with Luis is the following. Now, in this analysis, you find that the TV photon threshold would be significantly shifted by such a linearly suppressed term, okay? Meaning that you would not have absorption. So what we test is the prediction that you do not have absorption. You falsify, you put limits on eta, by the simple fact that you, when you do see it, if you do see absorption, then you translate that into a limit on eta. However, what if we add actually an absorption term to the dispersion relation, which is nothing, it's nothing.
You want to keep analyticity properties of the dispersion relations, I suppose.
Where do you see them going wrong?
When you add an absorption term, the imaginary parts, you have to be... It depends what you want to preserve.
Well, actually, in Luis's framework, it's really in a standard effective field theory framework. I'm really here taking a... This is not my preferred theory.
But you don't want the photon to decay. That's what I'm saying.
Well, why not? Phenomenology... This is the other way in which you place limits on this... Okay. No, when you have broken Lorentz symmetry, it's weird enough conceptually, but in practice you falsify it painfully by looking for photon stability, as you know. And
so when you do this, you put yourself in the phenomenology that the elementary particle, which is being described, that small d is elementary, but as the energy builds up, it's an effective particle, and it can disintegrate into
components. Yeah, this is the picture that...
This is how the imagination is going
to be. This would amount, in ordinary language, to one of these phenomenological frameworks that has been studied. One, when you break Lorentz symmetry, and you allow for the photon to decay. It's a very heavily constrained framework, experimentally, but I mean it's viable experimentally.
What is the test, the framework in which you get this imaginary test? What is the kind of framework you are using then?
We are not at the stage of test theory, but Luis will put it in a...
You need a reservoir in which particles decay, so you need to have a model for the reservoir.
Yeah.
It's a kind of Caldera-Leggett model, but kind of...
It's not yet a test theory. But we just, it's a very recent observation. But let me just make the point where it goes. So if you are not able to do, a dedicated analysis of this term, then you bring back in absorption. The first term eliminates absorption, and the next term introduces absorption. So this is just to illustrate the logic. Higher order terms.
Finish your sentence, please.
No, but I'm just addressing questions already for the last 5 minutes.
Right. Well, I guess I would ask the question. So one is going beyond Lorentz invariance in these various modified dispersion relations. But are you imagining that in adding complex things like this, that you're violating quantum mechanics or not?
That my punchline is not, no. Mm-hmm. This is not something I'm proposing. Actually, I have no... So this afternoon, it will look more like something I'm proposing. Now I'm making the case, how can we put limits on this parameter?
Yeah.
And I'm not proposing. I'm not advocating anything in particular. I'm not saying that this is... likable. I don't like
it. Well, I'm not saying it's likable or not either. I'm just asking the question because, certainly if you add such terms, then you will be, it looks like violating unitarity unless stated
yes.
in some other
sector. You will probably violate unitarity.
So I just
it want could to be constrained.
What the framework is, or what the vision is for, what should we keep and what shouldn't we keep?
No, I cannot put in this talk, this morning talk, I don't have rules for what we keep or we don't keep. Okay?
We just consider all
possibilities. We could consider all possibilities. Experiments must tell us what is not right. Okay? This is the position that I'm doing from the phenomenology side. I'm not advocating such a term, and not even this one, to begin with, in any sense. I'm just trying to make the point, can we place limits, robust limits, on this parameter? I don't particularly like it, nor dislike it. The same I could say of this term. Both are delicate phenomenological analysis. This is something which, for the first time, we are writing.
But you see, you're basically saying that you must know very well your test theory.
It's
discussion about higher order.
Exactly.
That when you ask for an test theory, you say, what is the image of space-time I'm putting inside?
This is the punchline of these two slides. I mean, the punchline of these two slides is that really, in the end, it's not that you cannot do this phenomenology, but you really need carefully tailored test theories. Since we don't have theories to compare directly to experiments, we need some test theory. So at some point, going back to the previous question, you cannot say, we will not be in a position to say we have put limits on ETA. But we will be able to say we have robust limit of eta, preserving unitarity and such. This is, if I can give you the idea of where I'm going. So the type of limits we will be able to robustly announce from this phenomenology are not going to be, we have eta constrained down to 10 to the minus 20 as such. It will be void of meaning for many reasons, including the fact that in a game where you have this large amplificators around, it would be hopeless to make a robust case for a limit like that. Instead, if you, as you know, and you know, I've been advocating for some time, if you have a test theory, now you have rules. You say, I'm not testing this dispersion relation to order eta, but I'm testing the presence of this dispersion relation in a framework where unitarity and these other things are still preserved. Then, by those arguments, let me just, this is to go back also. Now, once you have specified your framework by saying, well, I allow for this deformation, but I don't allow for this, this, and this, you might end up with something that can be really tested. Because by appropriate statement, I preserve unitarity, I preserve causality of this fuzzy causality, and so, you might basically constrain all extra things that you come into the game. Now, I'm not saying you cannot do the phenomenology, but it cannot be the case, as it has been done in many papers, it cannot be a phenomenology where you simply cite a limit on the parameter x. It will be a limit on the parameter eta.
You will change one thing in the theory and you don't allow arbitrary changes. And that really is what the phenomenologists have been doing. They've been saying change the dispersion relation but keep the rest of it as is.
That's a funny
lesson. Just a second. The situation is that Giovanni's time is basically up, but we do have 15 minutes for discussion. So, Giovanni, do you have some more slides to show us?
I just want to, well, I don't need to, but this is a short version. The short version, what I'd like you to keep away in spite of jet lag, which is, well, sensitivity to effects generally at the Planck scale is possible. The theoretical evidence story, I think you got. It's easy to get, I mean, it's obvious. What perhaps was not emphasized in previous works so much, not even by myself, is that we should stress some ability to discriminate between different scenarios, and I think I provided at least an illustrative example. You might be of a preference or not. Falsifiability is still far, but for some models like non-commutative geometry, we are still not there, but we might be getting ready to have actual predictions rather than theoretical evidence of effects. Now, the final part was on the use of test theories, which is something which those who are actually doing the phenomenology have been developing for some time. What you mean, I feel that we should, well, but now we do the discussion, and so I finish here. Let me postpone the discussion.
Discussion.
Yeah, coming back to this, whenever you have complex refractive indices, because that's what you're going to have if you put an eye, then of course you have absorption or decay.
Those are absorption terms.
Yes. Or decay.
Yes.
It's not clear. So you have an open system as Steve.
Yes.
So in principle, effective Lagrangians may not be written down.
You can write it.
I say may not. So in other words, we are back to this case, because that's a crucial relation, and we had a discussion, several discussions on this issue. So I would, okay, at the phenomenological level, before I start adding terms, complex terms, I mean the linear element, I would really try to have a more microscopic model in the back of my mind, which would determine the order of those effects. I mean,
And I understand yours too, and I appreciate yours too. However, it goes exactly in the opposite direction of my talk. My talk is I don't want to. Let me give you an opportunity. I don't want to put theoretical prejudice.
No.
I don't want to contaminate.
I agree.
With theoretical prejudice, the phenomenology.
I agree.
I have my own theoretical prejudice, for example, where the imaginary term, I see no reason why it should be there.
But however, I'll tell you one thing that Urrutia and other people have examined this analyticity, and they found what the dispersion relation is, and they dispute it. Because somebody want to say it.
Yeah, I would just to comment, the motivation for doing that is if you take a standard, field theory, effective field theory, and you require the reality of the electrical and magnetic fields, analysis gives you that if you don't have your fringes, the even powers of the fringes have to be imaginary.
But that's how it's, you see, if you impose analyticities at times,
But this new standard.
No, I agree here.
But let me stress. So this is theories debate, okay? Which I'm happy to join in this afternoon. Okay? We will have theories debate, and each one has his favorite. Now, my challenge today was to try to prove that we are able to do a phenomenology which is without theoretical prejudice. Okay. Now,
then you can do everything.
And Stefano's comment goes in that direction. You can do phenomenology with a test theory. It doesn't mean you introduce theoretical prejudice.
You are specifying
your framework. So your limits are not prejudicial, but they are specified. What I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Different is to instead imagine that you do some analysis and you imagine that you don't, you as a theorist, you're not willing to contemplate something like this, and then you quote a limit on eta without associating the limit with a specification of a test theory, which, for example, would forbid such term. I realize it's a delicate point. But I'm trying to make the point between a phenomenology which is free from theoretical prejudice, right? And justifiable theoretical prejudice, which I also have some of my own. But I must make the case, with all I've invested in this phenomenology, I must make the case that by careful tailoring of test theories, and perhaps it's something I should have added to the seminar, some examples of test theories we are trying to develop. It's difficult to tailor it in a way that you are then satisfied. But these limits on parameters will be strongly, you know, correlated with the test theory. Which what it means? With the theoretical prejudices you adopted in the analysis. Once you specify them, however, they are no longer prejudices. They qualify your limit. They qualify your experimental limit. So they are perfectly okay from a phenomenological perspective. If instead they are in the background, so if you somehow do the analysis and neglect some terms just because you don't like them, they are unacceptable, and then the limit is quoted as a limit on a given parameter, then you're not doing, you know, you're not establishing really scientific facts. This is the...
It seems to me that the so-called gravity is going to prison. How are you going to measure something with any relationship you do ever? Directly. You can only hope something fits down as a paper.
Well, I think the first part of the talk, I don't know if you were here, the first part of the talk, I think I made what I think at this point is a robust claim that we might actually see effects generally at the Planck scale. And the reasoning is the one of Brian Moser. So it's nothing unconventional. It's Einstein, the same God that led us to law of general relativity. Brownian motion is a way for effects at very different scales, to study effects at much shorter scales by observations at larger scales.
Okay. The cross-section, so scattering the gravity of the...
But you're not going to measure scattering of gravity. You're never going to measure scattering of gravity unless gravity becomes dV or 10 dV strong. If it is the gravity we know, we're never going to measure gravity of scattering. However, we might see some of these, say, space-time symmetries, which are more robust, experimental. Space-time symmetry tests, we might indirectly tell us about condensational space-time.
I had a slightly different question, comment, about your comment on group velocities and how they relate to the rate of energy with respect to momentum. Normally, I think we actually have two separate notions of dispersion relation around. One is the relationship between energy and momentum. The other is the relation between frequency and wave vector.
Right.
Normally, they're the same because we've got the Einstein-Rabaudi relations just relating energy to frequency and momentum. And in some sense, the group velocity, when you stop to think about the way it's normally defined, is associated with the omega decay. It is defined in terms of looking at a wave packet and seeing how the wave packet moves. And so I think that relation you're going to have to keep. But then the derivative of energy with respect to momentum, that requires additional assumptions about how frequency is related to energy and energy is related to momentum. Sorry, and wave vector is related
well,
to...
Well, but that's the Heisenberg principle.
That's exactly.
That's the Heisenberg principle.
That is the bit that you are... perhaps throwing away these DSR-related theories, that there has to be now a more complicated relationship between frequency and energy and between wave vector. And
well, you'll see an example this afternoon if you have.
Okay.
That's
another question?
I have a question about some of the special relativity. It may be very naive, but you mentioned that you realize that there's no such thing as a true boost.
Well, that's not okay. I will say more fully this afternoon, but not for doubly special relativity as a whole idea, but for a certain off-algebra description of symmetries, okay, which might be a mathematical realization of that idea.
My question was
not a pure boost.
If you consider transporting a vector in a closed loop, then will there be an accumulated rotation? And wouldn't this lead to a correction of Bertrand's precession analysis?
If you can be this here this afternoon, or now I can show you the formulas I will show this afternoon. It's not, I don't know if you can imagine what I mean by non-pure, but what you just described, this seems like the first plausible thing I hear about testing the non-pure. Yeah, I mean, my answer is I don't know because I never thought about it, but to me it seems worth discussing what you just proposed. Something which, if I understand correctly, you have just described a procedure that would give you zero if you had made a sequence of pure boosts. Now, that's a good idea, because probably what our results suggest, but it is theoretical evidence, as Lurek was forcing me to admit, but happily, I think. But this indication we have is that instead you couldn't possibly only have pure boosts. There should be a piece of rotation in there. And so, if I understand what you described, it seems to actually be a perfect codification of what I'm going to suggest this afternoon.
Can we just make a comment on your hyperbolic tangent business there?
Well, but that's wrong.
May I just
want the right one?
Well, maybe this is right. See, the thing is that if you take a function like the hyperbolic tangent, right, which is really a power series, and the federates, of course, any polynomial truncation of it is not going to have anything like that, because every polynomial just explodes. Not tangent hyperbolic, and hyperbolic tangent, of course, separates, right? So,
but I think you're going in my direction.
Exactly. Yeah, no,
I think so.
Maybe it is a good example. So basically, maybe what you're saying here is that you make us careful that power series expansion may not be resolved necessarily, because whenever you do a power series expansion, a Taylor expansion, you're assuming that it's a good idea to do this and to truncate it. But the truncation might totally go wrong at the high energy.
I guess it is increasingly unsafe.
Exactly. So
actually, in some other seminar, here I have it, okay? Some other seminar I gave, my punchline here was, I used to try to convince you that you could do Planck-scale physics with rather low-energy experiments. Today, I'm going to try to convince you that the best way to do Planck-scale physics is to use the lowest energy possible in experiments, which seems a priori weird. But if you have high quality, low energy data, from this perspective, from the perspective of protecting the analysis from some kind of uncontrolled behavior of the truncations, from that perspective, low energy, high quality data are preferable with respect to high energy, low quality data. You can easily argue for the same sensitivity, roughly, in two very different analyses. One which is a low energy, high quality analysis, and another analysis where you have high energies around but low quality. You might easily get the same sensitivity. These arguments are also an invitation to then, well, let's use low energy, high quality, where the behavior of the power series, which are either explicitly or implicitly playing a role in the analysis, is better controlled.
Giovanni, we are out of time. So let us thank Giovanni again.
Finally, we have...